Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Over the years, David Frum has been a frequent visitor to this program. His expert knowledge of current affairs has always been welcomed on these airwaves. Well, David is with us again tonight, but this time on a very different subject. Miranda Frum, the 32-year-old daughter of David and his wife Danielle, died this past February, and it has given the Frums an expertise in grief they never wanted but must now reckon with. David joins us now from Washington, D.C., and David, As I welcome you to the program, I think probably the best way to start this conversation, since we have somebody making a cameo on your lap right now, is for you to tell us the story of when you are in your kitchen making coffee and Ringo is there and you have a conversation with your daughter. Take it away.
So this is Ringo, my daughter Miranda's spaniel. My wife Danielle and I bought Ringo for Miranda as a gift in the spring of 2018. And they became boon companions. And Ringo was with Miranda when she was found after dying of the complications from a brain tumor. I wrote an article about the loss, and I began by talking about Ringo because he sort of summed up so much of Miranda's spirit. It was the summer of 2018. I was in the kitchen in Prince Edward County, Ontario, and Ringo walked up to the kitchen counter, lifted his leg and urinated all over the oven door with his eyes straight at me the whole time. I'm looking at you. And afterwards, I said, it was so aggressive and provocative. And I said to Miranda afterwards, I don't think Ringo likes me very much. And Miranda said, oh, he loves you. He just doesn't respect you, as you can see. Many things have changed over the years, but that does not. And but he was very demanding of my attention, so much so that, I said to Miranda, well, I think at least he likes to spend time with me. And she said, don't flatter yourself. He thinks of you as his assistant. And I said, okay, I'll take that. And Miranda said, but he has many assistants. He's a Hollywood dog. He has many assistants. Mom is assistant number one, and you are assistant number two. And that became my family nickname ever since, assistant number two.
You know, what I love about those stories is they show how absolutely whip smart funny your daughter was. Oh, my goodness.
Oh my goodness. She was she's the brightest wit in every room. She was so fast. She was also so, brave, not fearless because we all have fears. But she was diagnosed when she was 27 with this, highly advanced and dangerous brain tumor. And it was terrifying to her, of course, as it would be to anybody. And she retained an incredible wit all through that. And we quote her lines, and many of them are in the piece I wrote for The Atlantic. I'm conscious as I talk about her that I imagine everyone I'm talking to has losses of some kind or another. This is a world full of grief. And one of the things, grief is the great human equalizer. Suffering is the great human equalizer. You always have to be conscious when you speak that you're not just speaking for yourself because, you know, everyone's got their story and I've got mine. I think what I tried to do in the article I wrote about Miranda was to find how are we in this together? How do we, those of us who have to straggle on afterwards, how do we carry each other along?
Well, let's do an excerpt from that piece because it was an absolutely brilliant piece that you did for Atlantic. Sheldon, if you would, let's bring this graphic up. And for those listening on podcast, I'll read along. Here's David Frum in The Atlantic. For me, the thought of my own death has never been a distressing subject. We live, we love, we yield the stage to our children. I hoped that when the time arrived, I would have the chance for farewells. If that wish were granted, I could, with total content, ride the train to my final destination. It never occurred to me that one of my children might board the train first, pulling away as her parents wept on the platform. Okay, I don't mind telling you, this is probably going to be the hardest interview that I've ever done, just because you and I have known each other for a long time. And in order to sort of deal with the subject of grief, I'm going to have to ask you a bunch of questions I don't think I normally would, away from the cameras. So let's see how we do. How did you find out about Miranda's death?
It was about 20 to 11 on the morning of Friday, February 16th. I was preparing, as I so often am, for a podcast, in this case with Tim Miller of The Bulwark. We were to start at 11. And about 20 minutes before that, I received a text from my youngest daughter, who's studying a semester abroad, that one of Miranda's friends was trying urgently to get in touch with me. And so I called that friend back. And the friend shared the news that Miranda had been found, and the friend was very humane in the way she told the story. She said Miranda had someone came into the cleaner apartment once a week. The person had come in that morning, had found Miranda. She wasn't breathing. She called 911, and I said, "Has she been taken to the hospital?" And the friend had to then say, "No, Miranda's dead. She died in the night before." When the brain tumor that Miranda suffered from had done, although it was caught and removed, it was not a cancerous brain tumor. It was non-cancerous, but there's no such thing as a benign brain tumor. It was aggressive and advanced and had done a lot of damage to the glands of her brain, leaving her with a permanently depleted endocrine system. And your hormones regulate your whole body. They thirst, sleep, response to infection. And so she was vulnerable, and she was a person who loved life. She was not going to live as an invalid. She tried to live as a healthy person, as a normal person. And the two facts of the depleted immune and endocrine system and her determination to live life to the full, they met at about 3 a.m. on February 16th of this year.
Do you have any idea whether she knew she was dying?
I do know that in the 6 or 8 weeks before, she made a special point of visiting in person everyone in the world she loved in many, many different cities. She was always a footloose kind of person, but she went to New York, she went to Los Angeles, she went to Toronto. I don't think she was consciously saying goodbye, but it was like she was doing a last tour of this world she loved so well, and she loved her. The thing about, among the many things one might say about Miranda, she had this gift for making profoundly intimate friends extraordinarily quickly. And one of the stories about Ringo, she was walking Ringo in a park in Lower Manhattan, and there was an older man who with a sketchbook, and he made a sketch of Ringo and presented it to her. And he was slightly above the age where this was a flirtatious move, although who knows. So she got into conversation with him. It turns out he was an extremely well-known artist who's exhibited at the all the major New York museums, has works in the permanent collection. He was a veteran of the Israeli army in the war of 1973. And they became intimate friends. And she would visit with him and all because he had sketched Ringo. So she had people like that all over the world. And I think she bade them farewell.
Why did you and Danielle name her Miranda?
So Danielle and I met in the summer of 1987, and I'm a pretty cerebral person, as you know, but in this one domain, I am not cerebral at all. I think the topic of discussion on our fourth date was what would we call our children, we both love the name Miranda because it means literally something to wonder at, something to be amazed by. And I think the first use of it is in Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. And that suited her too, because she was a tempest.
I gather you have inherited Ringo now. This may be a bit of a strange question, but can you tell whether Ringo went through a grieving period not being with her?
He often had stayed with us when she would travel. So he was very used to us. There are other dogs here. We've got a kind of dog pack. So he was quite familiar. And especially in our place in Ontario, which he loves and chases the birds. So he's used to being with us for a week or 10 days, even 2 weeks. About 2.5 weeks after Miranda died, at about 4 a.m, he was lying at the foot of the bed and just let out suddenly in his sleep this howl, unlike anything we'd ever heard from him before, of distress and sorrow. And it was as if he had dreamed of her. Perhaps do dogs dream? I think so. We see their little feet running. He lay with her. He lay with her between the time she died and the time her body was found, about 6 hours later. When her body was moved, he was with her at her funeral in Toronto. He lay motionless beside the coffin. And when we laid her to rest in the earth, he stood by the edge of the pit and watched her in. And then ever after, he said, "I've been bonded to my wife." But yes, I think he knows. I think dogs grieve. Hmm.
You once asked Miranda, "Why does he bark so much?" What did she respond?
He's a bird hunter. I mean, he's just a maniac, and he just barks and barks at them. And I said to her, "You know, does he have to do that? Can we discipline him in some way?" And she said, "Well, why do you tweet?" I mean, it's the same impulse. Like, exactly. It's just like syllables into the vapor. Like, what's the blinking point? Who cares? And it's probably as noisy and disruptive in its own way as Ringo's barking. So you got me. She always got the last word. She had a last word to Ringo. Ringo, he's about stands 10 inches high at the shoulder, and he's very physically powerful because she lived for a while on the top floor of a six-story walk-up in Soho. And each stair was almost as tall as Ringo. So he would do a full body press up every step all the way up the six stories and then jump down. And it was like an Olympic athlete. So he's incredibly buff, but he is small. And when he would jump onto furniture or try to, and he would miss, Miranda would look around the room and then whisper to him, "Don't worry, no one saw."
I presume everybody is thinking right now the dog is obviously named after one of the Beatles. Is that in fact the case?
That is not the case. Huh. That is not the case. I'm going to bring you a little Canadian content here. So Lorne Greene, remember him? He was the Canadian CBC announcer who told the story of Canadian troops during the Second World War on CBC radio in the 1940s, and then went to Hollywood and had a big career there. It became probably best known role was he played the head of the family in the TV Western series Bonanza. So in the early 1960s, Lorne Greene wanted to diversify, and he wanted to make a record, but he couldn't sing at all. So he found this, I don't know whether he found it or it was written for him, it was an old, but he this ballad of a Western desperado named Johnny Ringo, who in the, I think, 1880s was a bank robber. A lot of people was an ex-Confederate soldier. And he made this ballad of Johnny Ringo and who terrorized the West. And he recorded that about 6 months before the Beatles became world famous. And the record was released about 6 weeks before the Beatles became world famous. And then to Lorne Greene's dismay, the Beatles made their American tour, and everyone assumed that his song on his album, which was supposed to make his singing career or his spoken word career, was about Ringo Starr. But of course, it wasn't. It was about this figure from American history. And Miranda named Ringo after the outlaw Johnny Ringo because she knew from the first moment she met him, this guy's an outlaw.
That sounds like a very Miranda thing to do. Not after the famous Beatle, but after something much more obscure.
Yes.
I think so. David, how does a father who presumably has never prepared himself for this moment, because you, of course, hope like hell it'll never happen, how do you even begin to figure out how to put one foot in front of another after this happens?
Yeah. Well, as you saw in that sample you read about, I'm not phobic about my own death. I have elaborate plans in place. There are documents in file, and you know, all my, by the way, one of the things I recommend anyone listen, if you take one thing away from this, make sure you have a list of your passwords for all your computer programs and make sure your loved ones know where they are. So I have that in a folder, you know, here are my passwords. Here's when the gas bill is due. Here's my will in the folder. Here's the insurance policy. It's all, and my wife and I have begun planning where we would be buried someday together. And we had revolved many options, and we finally resolved there's a small Jewish cemetery near Prince Edward County, halfway between Trenton and Belleville, just east of the Canadian Forces Base. And we thought, you know, that would be convenient to where our children would be, because they're going to stay in Prince Edward County. So we'd begun shopping for that. And then we had to suddenly, very fast, make all the decisions that we were non-phobically preparing for ourselves and make them for a child. And that is, as everyone's got losses, the thing about the loss of it, the loss of a child, I mean, there are many kind of griefs. I think Canadians have just witnessed the incredibly beautiful ceremony for former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and saw his loving family there. But there are things you psychically prepare for, even if you never talk about the husbands and wives psychically prepare. One of us will outlive the other. That just has to be the way. But children certainly prepare for their parents as much as they dread it. They're ready for it. You're not ready for the loss of a child. And there's something else. I read something just today by a writer who lost his beloved partner of many years and how he's begun to see other people. And when he flirts with other women, that he thinks about what his partner would think. And he thinks about it with some warmth and amusement. Well, you can love your partner as much as that man did and still 2 or 3 years later begin to see other women. There's no other child. Oh. There's no, you don't say, we'll have, that's it. And of course, the door is closed behind you because this was going to be your future. For me, I did great. I'm a religious believer, but I'm not I don't have much confidence in any individual consciousness after death. So I don't think for me there's any hope, but my hope was always that my children would be happy. I'd provide for them and leave them memories of me, and they'd at first be sad and then think, then laugh. That's the way of the world.
I imagine you have been inundated by those who want to do the right thing, say the right thing, be helpful, all of that. What have you learned, and what can you tell us on that list of here's a good thing to say, here is something you should never say?
Look, the things you should never say are, so I won't insult the TVO audience by suggesting that there's anyone who would watch this program who would say something you shouldn't say. The big problem that the kind of sensitive and intelligent person who would watch you would have is people are sometimes afraid to say anything because they become so afraid of saying the wrong thing, they say nothing. So unless you are just a boorish, oafish person, anything you say is going to be better than nothing. And it really comforts. And some things, and just because of who, there's a random process that there are many people who comfort, there's a person who's consoled, and different people will respond to different things. So you may say the right thing, and it may be as beautiful as you say it. It might not be the thing that person needed to hear that. It's okay. It's like the total volume. It's the things that fill the air. If there's enough confetti in the air, you can catch some of it. And for us, the thing we keep quoting back and forth to each other. And I, by the way, I've used this story before and the person heard it and said, you can use my name, so I will use the name. We got a note from someone I know a little bit who's a senior agent at WME, Robert Newman. And he lost his daughter, Leah Newman, at age 33. She died after giving birth to a child. He and his wife, Cindy, they had 4 children. And this was the child who most wanted a child of her own and then lost her life giving birth to the healthy child that lost her own life. And we have had some conversations with the Newman family. And Robert, being a Hollywood agent, said, the thing an agentese that I found, Danielle and I have quoted this 50 times, he said, if the angel of death were to appear to you as a parent and say, I can bring your child back, but you have to jump off this 10-story building, you do it without looking back. You do it with a smile on your face. He said, but that's not on the table. and that phrase, that's not on the table, has become, as we think, we have 2 other children, we have to live for them. We have a marriage, we have to keep that going. We have a lot of other dogs in this house, and they all need to be fed every damn day 2 times and walked. You can't exit this earth. So you have to focus on what's on the table and what's not on the table. And for me, that was helpful. But I would say, if you're listening to this for any kind of inspiration, what to do, don't worry. Just do something. And maybe it'll be the right thing, maybe not, but you'll be one of 40 people. And I guarantee one of them will say the weird thing, and the way that that's not on the table resonated with Danielle and me, that somebody will say it. Maybe it'll be you, but just don't be afraid, because you're not going to say the oafish thing. There are one or two people. I mean, we have heard from so many people that just because of the law of big numbers, there were one or two oafs. But if it's less public, and instead of hearing from hundreds or thousands, you hear from dozens, there aren't going to be any oafs. There are not so many. Most people in the world reserve their oafish behavior for trolling on the internet, not for talking to grieving people.
Right on. You just referenced the fact that you have two other children, and who, yeah, I have to say, spoke absolutely magnificently at their sister's funeral. They were incredible. Yeah. I wonder if you can compare the kind of grief they are experiencing at losing a sibling versus what you are going through as a parent.
Well, I've heard now from a number of people who have been in the situation themselves that sibling loss is really an underappreciated phenomenon, because everyone gets that the parents of a lost child are going to be crushed. But the loss of the siblings is huge, too. And I mean, our three children were particularly close. But even when not close, I mean, even if think of it, I mean, if you're married and you have a brother or sister, and the conversation goes on to weird things that happened in your family in 1969, your spouse is going to go to bed before your brother or sister does. And they're going to get weary of the whole subject. The only people who are interested in the tiny little civilization that was your childhood are your siblings. Not even your loving spouse can endure as much of it as your siblings can. And so when they are co-citizens of this tiny civilization that was your childhood, and the civilization that is just lost. Childhood is always lost. But you keep it alive inside you, but it's gone. And in our case, there was a big age gap between the two older children, 2 years apart, and the youngest, Bea, who was 8 years younger than her brother and 10 years younger than her sister. When sisters are 10 years apart, I've observed that one of two things can happen. That's a tremendous maker of distance because their experiences are so different. Or it's tremendous bonding relationship because the 10-year-old sister becomes a kind of backup mom, a cooler and more understanding mom than the actual mom. A mom you can tell some of your less creditable adventures to in a way that you'd better, the two of you can be co-conspirators and covering them up from the actual mom who would be upset. And so Brandon B had this intense relationship. Nat and Miranda had this intense relationship, and they are, but they're carrying on in her, they're going to keep her memory alive. I mean, odds are I've got only so many years of keeping her memory green, but those two children and their children in time will keep her memory green into the next century.
Every couple deals with this differently. I've talked to couples in the past who immediately go out and join a group of other parents who've been through this, and they find comfort in that. Others want to stay far away from that. Have you figured that out yet?
Yeah, I would say two about the couple thing. I mean, let me just, if we're dealing with things that people might find useful. So the first thing I would say is, if you have the good fortune to have a real functioning marriage, it's really important to keep it going. Because the marriage can easily be a casualty. Men and women grieve differently, and misunderstandings can grow in the space between the way men and women grieve. And husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, they grieve differently. It's really important that you, like, from the beginning, say, we're doing this. We made this person as a partnership. We raised her as a partnership. We have to mourn her as a partnership. And you cannot allow any space to come in between you in that time, even though it's a time of pressure. And space can materialize. Space doesn't materialize. Space can, cracks can materialize, and bad things can appear in the cracks. Some people find groups very helpful. It depends somewhat on the circumstances also of the loss. People have had very specific mental illness, suicides, victims of homicide. For us, I think Danielle and I have really made a decision that grief is not going to be our next career. We have things we need to do on this earth. We are going to do them, and we will grieve as a family, but we're not going to be, we talk to people who have helpful things to say, but we're not joining permanent groups. I want to stress they can be for people with certain particular kinds of losses. They can be magnificently supportive and indispensable.
Mm-hmm. This next question may be the hardest one I'm going to ask here. So here goes. Fair warning. Even if our kids scrape a knee on the playground, we as parents always ask ourselves, was there anything we could have done to ensure that that scraped knee didn't happen? So how do you handle those moments where you are asking yourself right now, is there anything we could have done to prevent this?
Yeah. That's an important question. It's a painful question to answer because in our case, the question, was there something that could have been done differently? The answer is yes. Miranda was on this array of artificial hormones to, again, regulate her sleep, regulate her thirst, regulate her immune system. And it was a moving target. You always had to be adjusting them and changing them, and you had to be you had to really keep on top of it. And it had to dramatically circumscribe your own life because you had to keep a very, you know, travel was a lot of things you wouldn't think travel was dangerous. Exposure to other people was dangerous. Any irregularity in routine was dangerous. So, theoretically, if we could have gotten a court order and sentenced her to live in some desert climate forever and go wake up the same day and go to bed every day and have no stress and very little company and no travel. If you don't have an immune system, it's going to catch up with you sooner or later, but it didn't have to catch up with her that day. But when I say all of that, you realize the impossibility of it because, Miranda wanted to live, but if you had said the price of living to 80 is to live forever as an invalid. And if you want to live, if you want to live in full, it's a risk. Miranda always took risks. She made her living as a fashion model. She was working in Israel during the 2014 Hamas war. She didn't leave. She continued to do photo shoots. She learned to become a foreign correspondent. So she was simultaneously posing for glamorous photographs and then going to bomb scenes and interviewing people and writing up her recollections, which appeared in the Daily Beast. When she was, would travel in Europe with friends, and during that time and after, there's a lot of anti-Semitic intimidation, as people know, in the cities of Europe. And when she was at close quarters in the Paris subway, and she would begin speaking Hebrew loudly when people tried to intimidate her to make it clear, I am not backing down. That was the person she was. And if the price of living a little longer was to not be the person she was, she wouldn't have made that agreement much as we would have recommended it. And there isn't a court that would have given us the order that we needed to make her enforce. And then we would have just spent our time in bitterness with us being the scolds to tell her the only way for you to live is not to live.
David, do you think it will be possible for you, your wife, your kids, your extended family, ever to be happy again?
Ever to be happy. So it feels like an amputation. And then you turn on the TV and there are people with amputated legs running faster than people with two legs. There are people with amputated arms climbing mountains that are so hazardous that, you know, you'd have questioned the mental health of someone who went up them with both arms. People function. There are people who function through grief and suffering and pain. That's our common lot as human beings. I can imagine that you can live a life where you avoid it by space. Like if you just space everything out so perfectly, you live happily and then die yourself before anyone you care about very much dies ahead of you. You can avoid it that way, or you can just be an obtuse, unfeeling, and sociopathic person, and then that's a great way to avoid grief. I don't think sociopaths ever feel grief for anybody, but it's our lot, and then you have to say so. You just have to have a more tragic kind of happiness. So my late mother, Barbara, many people watch the show will remember, she died at 54. I think Canadians remember that she died early, but they forget she was 54, died in March of 1992. She didn't die suddenly. She was diagnosed with the disease that killed her when she was 37 and was told you have a very short time to live. And the doctors kept giving her extensions, but she had 2 years to live at age 37. Then she was given two more years at age 39 and so on until it caught up with her at age 54. But she always said that there are people who know and there are people who don't know. So every time you bite into a raspberry, and feel that joy, it's a joy filled with tragedy, because to all of us, there are only so many raspberry seasons.
Last question, David. As luck would have it, I got together last week with somebody who lost a child at a very early age, much younger than Miranda. And when I asked her, when people ask you how many kids do you have, she always answers, two living.
Yes.
She had three, but she says two living. And if people want to follow up on what that means, they can. And if they'd rather not, they move on. Have you thought about how you will answer that question in the future?
I have to. She anticipated me. That's exactly the way I would answer it. I think that's right. I mean, that's a little bit more tactful. I would say I had three, I have two, but I like her answer better. It's because it's the same concept but expressed more tactfully, because it gives the person the option of not asking. You know, about a month after we lost Miranda, I was involved in some very routine service that I use a lot, and a person I see every 10 weeks and provides a service, and she asked me how I was. Do I tell her? She doesn't need that. Her life's difficult enough. She's got problems of her own. So I just said, it's fine. Thank you. Not everybody needs to have everything laid on them.
I get you. David, as I said to you in the email when we set this up, I really wanted to talk to you because I thought your experiences in dealing with grief could help a lot of other people. And I know for certain you've done that tonight. So thank you.
Thank you.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.